Welcome to the Connected for Real podcast. I'm Revitin Batren Grossman, a marriage coach for women in business. And my mission is to bring God's presence into your life, into your marriage, and into your business. Let's get started. Welcome to the Connected for Real podcast. I'm Revitin Batren Grossman, and today with me is the most awesome person in the world, my husband. This is a really fun episode. If you guys didn't know, we are in a series where every month there is a different focus, a different word, and we come at it from the four different pillars. So we have God, marriage, business, and you. And every time we take the 4 weeks of the month to really address the same exact topic from different angles. So now we are starting the topic of routine. As you have noticed, we are in September. This is the time where people are like hoping to get back into a routine with their kids and with life. There's also a new year coming. So it usually comes with new routines and trying to change yourself and all that good stuff. So for this episode, I chose my husband to speak about routine and God because he is really, really good at that. Oh. And definitely my pillar for routine. So first, we're going to start with introductions and then we'll get right into it. Rabbi Avi Grossman, introduce yourself and tell everyone why you are so awesome.
I'm so awesome. I guess kids like me a lot. That's a good thing. My own children like me, you know. Yes. I go to my son's gone. I'm the most popular father there. They all want to give me high fives.
Yes. You know?
Okay. I'm very nice with children because I behave like one myself. I don't know. I try to study and also produce content like books, right? To show that I'm actually studying, getting somewhere. And I do my own weekly podcast like thing. It's chopped up and put on the internet also by someone else.
Yeah.
Yeah. So cool. It's very nice. Yeah. It's very popular. And we have some loyal students, which are also nice to have around, you know, and that's it.
Sounds good. Okay, let's start talking about, in general, routine. Why did God create routine? Why do we need routine in order to serve God? All that good stuff.
To be honest, I don't know why God created anything.
Okay, well.
I don't think anybody knows him. Someone tries to tell you he's probably a charlatan. That's too fancy a word. He's probably a fraud, a faker. But it is something that's commanded in the Torah. One of the most interesting aspect is right at the beginning of creation, we have the introduction of the work week, 7 day cycle, right? So it was one thing if we could say, metaphysically speaking, God created the world in 6 days and then rested on the seventh. But what happens thereafter? Wow. From now on, human beings will have to live in a cycle of weeks, 6 work days, and a sanctified seventh day of Sabbath, a day of rest. So that's the first routine that creation has and that we live in. And most people, if they're in touch with their Judaism, you know, they're living toward Shabbos. So routine is built into the creation. Then we have on the fourth day, God actually creates the luminaries. Why does the sun, the moon, and the stars exist? I don't know why God created everything, but I do know that this part of creation actually says why. You know, this is one of the first only times, doesn't say why God created man and animals, but does say why he created the sun, the moon, the stars. And that's what? To keep track of time. And it turns out they're cyclical in nature. Not only is it the passage of time, it's the cyclical passage of time. Moons basically define a month. And the way the sun goes across the sky and returns to its, you know, different, you know, I guess a different part of the horizon over the course of the seasons, that tells us that a year has passed by. And also, it so happens that with the sun's seasons, you know, it's closer to the south or closer to the north, it rises every day in the east, sets in the west. It also, the weather changes. You know, so God built routine into creation. Okay. And even if a person's unaware of the week, he's not counting toward the Sabbath. He actually just has to look up at the sky. And after a few days, he'll realize, oh, there's a routine going on here. And the Jewish people are commanded to keep the commandments, commanded to keep commandments. Oh, wow. That was really fancy. And the most basic commandments are cyclical in nature. You know, we have to pray every single day, 3 times every day. There's a morning prayer, an afternoon prayer, an evening prayer, sometimes additional prayers. You know, corresponds to what they did in the temple, which was the basic same service every day. The only difference was on holidays, it was just more of the same service. Sabbath is just double what you do on a weekday. So routine is built into the creation. Apparently, routine is what keeps a person aligned. I'm speaking just for men. God gave men routines because without their routines, they'd fall into perhaps, you know, doing things that are probably not the best use of their time.
Okay, so just because you said about men, we're talking mostly to women on this podcast. What do you think
I'm sorry.
Is, no, it's good. What do you think is the need for routine in regards to women? Or how does the fact that they are not bound by time commandments, by time-bound commandments, not bound by time-bound commandments.
Not obligated to keep the certain time-bound commandments. Yeah.
Correct. So how does that affect their routine or the way that they serve
God? Women could still build a routine. It just makes it easier for them. Or men are stuck. There's one way. This is the right way. Men, for example, it's been pointed out, men wear uniforms, okay? Whether it's military uniform or otherwise. Men, when they go about their lives, like a form of uniform. And it's even the case that among many Jews who don't have an official mandatory uniform because they're not part of, let's say, an army, they adopt one anyways. Okay. There's certain men I know that if they have a certain job, let's say mine, they only wear white shirts. And most of the time they just wear ties. And they don't have any variety except for maybe the color of their tie. Even their yarmulke doesn't have anything. So there's, you know, they wear uniforms that befits men to do such a thing. It's about formality. Whereas for a woman, her expression of herself is she wears something different every single day. And like, you know what that's like.
Yeah. Right? And it's really interesting because we just ended an entire month about clothing and style. So well, that's really fun.
So for men, it doesn't, that's not works. They're different creatures altogether. Nashim an bifnei atzman hein is an expression from the Talmud saying women are like their own nation. It's like there's a nation of men and a nation of women. Okay. Men and women are totally different from each other. I know why it's good that men like me have routines and we have uniforms, you know, that reflect our stations in life and what we're trying to broadcast to the world. But women have totally different role in life. So they're not bound by this because they, you know, it would probably change day to day. Just like a woman wears different colors and different outfits based on her mood, right? So too her form of service of God. Whereas a man, let's say, is bound by Shacharis, a certain time of day, to say Kriyat Shema, same words every single day. For a woman, it's more from the heart. You know, it's, I guess it's open to, I wouldn't even say artistic interpretation, but emotional interpretation. Okay. A woman is therefore more at liberty to find ways that she serves God. And perhaps even, yes, she should have some sort of routine, but a lot less legislated. She creates her own routine, and her routine might very well be radically different from that of her friend next door. Whereas two men, they probably have a routine that overlaps majorly, especially if they attend synagogue every single day. They'll meet up at the synagogue.
Right.
And if they'll go to the same synagogue, they're, you know, it's the same synagogue service going on everywhere else. You could probably, you know, even though we say, well, this one's different, you know, they're Sephardim or something like that. To be honest, here in Kochav Yaakov, how many Sephardim are at the Ashkenazic and how many Ashkenazim are at the Sephardic mini in the morning? It's all the same, you know. But for women, you know, it's like I prayed this place. I went over there and I prayed. I have my own special place of prayer, just like Abraham had his own place of prayer. So
you're saying there's a lot more freedom within routine for women to find the routine that works with their.
And is it even routine? A woman builds her own routine, and then she could tomorrow, you know, change it. You know, that's the whole thing. Even if she has a routine, it's not mandatory.
Yeah.
It's not mandated by some sort of religious code.
Guys, this works really well with what we've been talking about, which is like, you know, the seasons of life. Something works really well when you have young kids, but then when they grow up, you have to rethink everything. Oh, man. Or just the cyclical nature of our business, where sometimes we have certain things and certain needs, and sometimes we don't. So it's really interesting that this is very much built into the separation between men and women. Cool.
Okay, cool. Yeah.
Yeah. Where else do we see routine? Let's talk about marriage.
Hold on a second. Yeah. Routine has two meanings in English. One is that which you do every single day. You know, it's your, they say Seder Ayom, the order of the day.
Okay.
Which, by the way, even part of the prayers, it's like the final section, the additional section of the morning prayer for men is called Seder Ayom.
Okay.
Okay. I mean, in the daily routine. But sometimes routine, let's say you use it as an adjective, it becomes too regular. I use a modern Hebrew word starting with the sages, hurgal. Okay. It means it's become too regular. It's almost autopilot. Okay. You know, you have to watch out for that. If a person develops a Seder, his daily order, but it is too routine, such that it's lacking all feeling or originality, or there's something new to it. You know, that's bad. That's, you know, they say don't pray on autopilot. What is that? Well, it's the same. You're using the same prayer book every day. So instead of saying it from the heart with sincerity, you might fall into the trap that's like now it's just by rote. That is bad. Rote and routine related words. So the routine could, like I said, an adjectival form could be pretty bad when you have to get out of it. If it's just a routine, then you have a major problem. If it's just, you know, going through the motions, bow down, strap on those tefillin every day, do the same thing, that could be stagnation. You know?
Ooh.
Stagnation. Okay, so watch out, you know. Don't get too much into routine. The routine is what God recommends you do, but you have to supply the feeling, the emotion, you know, what they call kavana. You know,
so success. Now we're getting into something really interesting. The routine that we're going for is, you know, I just want to know what to expect. I want to know that I'm getting into a rhythm, into systems that work for me and in which I can thrive. But then there is a negative part of that, which is if you get into something that's so autopilot, you lose yourself. How do we make sure that we don't get to that extreme, that we don't lose the reason why we put those routines in place to begin with?
Okay. So first of all, sometimes you need a routine. Or to live your life, you need a routine. For, let's say, people like us, a routine is necessary. You have to know what time you're waking up in the morning because the kids got to get to school on time, right?
Okay.
And things got to get done. You have to be somewhere, you know, at 9 a.m. in the morning or sometimes significantly earlier, right?
Yeah.
You have to do your commute. So certain parts of your routine are innocuous, but also necessary. Okay. So, and that could lead to, like I said, the stagnation. When it comes to the service of God, how do you prevent something from being routine? Oh boy, that is the million-dollar question. I know that there are some men, pious men, who make sure to wake up extra early in the morning. Okay. When it's, you know, the world is still, you know, like the last part of the night, every single day, so that they have time to concentrate, to meditate on these aspects. So the sages said that it used to be the pious men of old. They used to spend an hour in meditation before davening in the morning. That was before praying in the morning, an hour.
Mm-hmm.
So, wow. So you have time. Think of something, saying the Psalms. And even then, well, how many Psalms are there? There's only about 150 of them or so, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So you have to, even that can become routine. If you've been through the book of Psalms, you know it so well. So you have to, wow, you got to come up with something else. Yeah, I think that's, if I were an expert at this, knowing how to break the routine of service of God, then, you know, I'd be a lot farther in life. But I really don't know. For a lot of times also, for a lot of men, you wake up in the morning, and even if you have a decent time to daven, that's to pray, it might be that that's your routine. It's using the same prayer book. You still have 20 minutes. Even then, you don't manage to get to somewhere new.
Mm.
Yeah. So one of the things that I did starting about, I remember first did this maybe 27 years ago, was just mix and match the prayer book. I mean, you can, there's so many different slightly different formulas. I'll get back to the Ashkenaz Sephardic thing. There's a lot more than that.
Right.
So you probably see my collection of Siddurim. You probably know that I have with my tefillin. I used to use a very specific Hasidic sitter. And even that, you know, I've been through the Ashkenazic Siddur and the Sephardic Siddur and the Nusach Sfarad, which is the Hasidic Siddur, the Nusach Eretz Yisrael Siddur. Sometimes you need something new. At least mix and match your prayer book. And even then, there's only so much. And
you're
so you
saying change the words so that they force you to think.
Yes, yeah, so you have to. You're not on autopilot. And take some time also before prayers to say psalms that you're not used to. Everybody knows Pesukei Dizmor, the usual psalms that make up the beginning of the morning service. That starts with what's known as Ashrei, the 145th psalm.
Okay.
If I'm not mistaken, going on from there. So perhaps you should, you know, mix it up a little bit. I definitely think that they should do this, something I do, with regards to the extra supplications after the main silent devotion part of the prayer, which is called the Shmoneh Esrei, for those who are in it. So there's a time for what's called Tachanun, supplications. So normally in the Siddur, it's just one psalm there, one specific psalm. For the Ashkenazic Siddurim, it has Psalm 6. And in the Sephardic ones, it's like Psalm 42 or something like that, or 43.
Okay.
Might be mistaken. Either way, I go through all the psalms that aren't specifically the Psalms of Thanksgiving. So if you could break up the psalm book, you know that a lot of those psalms are different forms of supplication. So I make sure to go through, like, Today I said Psalms 1 through 5.
Okay.
That's saying, and how often I don't get to that. Maybe once every 2 months I get to that. So that certainly breaks up the routine. And you could find other things. Prayer book, but so this is very this is highly technical.
Okay, so what you're saying is change things up,
yeah,
and try to stay intentional. And we talk a lot about being intentional in our work here.
Yeah,
for women, a lot of the things we do are on autopilot because there's a lot of repetitive things, and there's a lot of things that we hope
we keep reiterating things, and we repeat things, we say it over and over again.
Right, exactly.
I'm too repetitive, and then you're repetitive, and you're repetitive over and over again.
It gets tiring, and then we get really sick of it, and then we don't know what to do. And so bringing in a little bit of intentionality is always the best way to do it. And we have a lot of different tricks that we use in order to stay on top of it and not let it pull us down. Let's talk about marriage a little bit, routine and marriage.
But we just met. Okay,
we're actually celebrating 18 years soon. 19. I want your take on routine and marriage. And when you think of routine and marriage, what comes up for you, and is it good or bad for the marriage to have routines?
I don't know. Don't take your spouse for granted, that's for sure. Don't expect the Rosh Kol tells us, don't come home saying, where's the food? Where's this and that? Why isn't this done? No, expecting just to be appreciative of what you get every single day. If you demand too much from your spouse, you'll start keeping them to hold their higher standards than they could stand up for, Let's say, just take our situation. Stuck with kids, You can't expect that someone's stuck a few hours with the children that they did anything beyond than just making the house, rubble. If the house is still standing and there's not, god-awful stuff on the floor, so you should be happy, Too many men walk in, they want all their laundry done, their shirts ironed, and they want a sandwich. Look, I'm sure some men actually get that, but everybody comes in with that expectation. It's not going to help you. Actual routine, who knows? How about this? Strive as a man to have a routine that you make sure you always give your wife compliments, right? And do the flowers. I used to say, I haven't seen flowers around, but flowers are an obligation every Friday, right? Before the Sabbath.
Sure, sounds like a plan.
The exact amount or how much you shell out for those flowers doesn't really matter, as long as it's something. But a man has to have a routine in how he honors and respects and, all that other stuff for his wife. But he should expect nothing in return. Okay. And that could be, I'm sure Bali Musr would say that's a good thing. And also women should know. Because the best thing you could tell any woman, and just to get her to understand this, is just do what your husband asks for. There are a lot of women out there who would say, I want to do something for my husband. He expects so much and this and that. And they go out overboard when maybe it's just the husband's asking for, a nice beer and a chocolate chip cookie. Mm-hmm. That's very simple things. Men just want simple things. I think I heard some women say there's three things a man does. Just make sure you do these three things. And, it's very easy because men we're pretty simple creatures. The way to a man's heart is through his stomach. So it's true. Okay.
You crack me up.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know, but whatever. God gives us routines in life. The most important thing, raising a family means that God is already dictating a routine. And the fact that you have to get ready for the Sabbath every night, you have to get the kids ready for sleep. You already have a God-given routine.
Right.
The trick is just don't let it get to your head. And, just try to be nice. What am I? Am I an expert at this thing?
I don't know. You seem to be doing well.
You should know people think my own expertise. I don't even know if I have an expertise. The thing that people tell me I have an expertise is usually just stuff like finding something in a book and pointing that there, like, or combining two things in a book. Like, what's the answer? Well, there's two things in a book here. The resolution is this. But these really complicated real life questions, God knows. No, I'm serious. These aren't the things you can find in a book, or you can't do a few, math problems, calculation on paper and find an actual answer.
Right. These are more like EQ stuff.
Yeah, instead of IQ.
Yeah.
I remember that. Okay, fine. Next.
Yeah, cool. A question came in that wants your attention. I mentioned last week in my episode that I am planning on going to the Temple Mount. I actually ended up going, and you came with me, which was really nice. And a couple of questions came in. So how are you allowed to go up to the Temple Mount? And, you know, what exactly do you need to do in order to go there? You know, isn't it not allowed or forbidden? And I wanted to just address that as a side point, because I think it's important for people to hear.
Hey, before we continue the episode, I want to ask you something. Are you ready to get answers from God directly? Feel more in love with your husband and more supported than ever? Run the business of your dreams without having to sacrifice any other part of your life? That is exactly what my one-on-one private coaching is for, and I want to invite you, just you and me, for a free deep dive discovery call. This is a 60-minute free call where I ask you lots of questions and we extract the three main things that are holding you back. I then put together a personalized plan for you where I create a roadmap of recommendations with practical steps. The call is free and so valuable in itself, so go book yours today. Now, back to the show.
Let's get controversial. The Kuzari, among others, brings an interesting argument for the veracity of our Torah tradition. And he says that all the Jewish people attest to the truthfulness of the revelation at Sinai. Okay, you couldn't convince a nation of millions that, here, you all were at Sinai, you all heard God's voice, you all received the Torah at once. If it didn't actually happen, you couldn't convince everybody that it did. And then they say, yeah, this tradition would be a prank. Okay. Right. However, my faith in that particular argument, I totally believe in God and in the revelation at Sinai, but that particular formulation argument, maybe I question it, because I have seen in our day and age, the Jewish people convinced of a non-truth. Millions of Jews believe in non-truth that was recently created, and that is that it is forbidden, objectively forbidden, to go to the Temple Mount, and that Jews have always, let's say, prayed at the Kotel. Nothing could be further from the
Western
truth.
Wall.
The Western Wall, the Wailing Wall, as they may have called it. What was is attested to in history that at a certain point during the Ottoman stewardship, if I could call it that, that's a nice way of saying it, the occupation of Eretz Israel, the land of Israel, which was classically called Palestine since Roman times. Jews, by the way, always called it Palestine. Okay. Now, that's like that was the foreign word, the non-Hebrew term used for land of Israel in non-Jewish languages. So the Jews always used to go until they were forbidden from doing so. And
they used to go up to the Temple Mount
as much as they could. You know, there was limited, and of course, you know, various authorities in different ages didn't want Jews rebuilding the temple as an act of rebellion. There's conquerors and empires, and you know, the history of the land being fought over. I say, like Yaakov Kershon's example, like a bone being fought over by a bunch of dogs. You know, the whole Crusades. What was the point of all those, you know, centuries of conflict of the Crusades? European Christians trying to take away the land of Israel from, you know, foreigners, Muslims, infidels, as it may be. So the Ottomans had a system of keeping the Jews away from the Temple Mount officially. And they're the ones with their waqf, that is the Muslim Trust, created a very small, limited Jewish prayer area near the Western Wall.
Right.
And that is what people in, let's say, by the 1800s, late 1800s, were familiar with, that the Jews cannot go on the Temple Mount. And they have a place to pray near the Temple Mount, and that's it. And when the mandatory period came about, that was the British Mandate of Palestine, between World War I and World War II, this basically was reaffirmed by the newly formed chief rabbinate of the Jewish community of Mandatory Palestine, as Rav Kook himself eventually wrote, as a matter of political expedience. That is, they declared, it was like by fiat, the Jewish people should not be going on the Temple Mount, you know, for quasi-religious reasons. That was what they officially said. But really, it was for political reasons. And perhaps, let's say, as a temporary measure, it had its utility. But after the founding of the state, when the Temple Mount and anything in near the old Jerusalem was out of Jewish hands, it was basically irrelevant. And after the Six-Day War, which was in 1967, June 1967, when it suddenly became through miraculous providence that the old city of Jerusalem fell back into Jewish hands, it once again became permissible or possible. And great rabbis who were aware of this fact tried to go to the Temple Mount and advocated for it. I don't think the Jewish people were ready at the time. Really, they should have been rebuilding the temple because there's a commandment to do so. But the old ways, that which had become ingrained, the problem with Jews is that we have a certain stubbornness to us. That's almost like a genetic thing. Came not going to the Temple Mount is now something that's a religious imperative. It must be forbidden. Our good friend Dr. England says that that's an unfortunate Jewish tendency, almost a routine, if you will. That once we're used to doing something, let's say staying in the diaspora, we then concoct Talmudic sounding justifications for such a thing, and almost we create so much of a justification to explain it that we almost declare that it must be that way. Whatever is must be that way. So the Jewish people haven't broken out of this. This, by the way, existed on a very similar level for the idea of Jews moving back to the land of Israel and settling the land of Israel and even having an autonomous state in the land of Israel. It didn't exist for so long that when that push began to, that push began among Jewish people to resettle the land of Israel and immigrate to Israel in large numbers and even found the state, there was extreme religious opposition. Can you believe that? Nowadays, such a thing doesn't exist. We all forgot about it. It may exist, and even some places they still say, we shouldn't have done this. But no serious Jewish community believes such a thing. Now we're used to this. We've gotten over that hump. So too, Am Yisrael has to get over this prank, basically, that they've been told that this is forbidden. It's nothing farther from the truth. The Jewish people are actually commanded every single day to, if they don't have a temple, to build a temple. If it exists, to upkeep the temple. That's one commandment. And there's many other commandments. We say, what's the most routine commandment in the Torah from which we learn the daily prayers? You have to offer sacrifice in the temple every morning and every evening. And by evening, I mean late afternoon.
Right.
And that the order of those two services is exactly the same every single day. Okay? The priest has to offer the lamb and burn it and set up the fire, light the menorah, offer the incense. It's the same every morning and every afternoon. Every morning is the same as the afternoon. Slight difference between morning and afternoon because it's one's morning, one's afternoon. But it's the same service twice every single day of the week, every single day of the year.
Right. The repetitiveness.
Yeah. Repetitive. So God's routine demands us to be on the Temple Mount. We've forgotten this. We think, we say that we shouldn't be there. So if someone's telling you it's forbidden, it just means that he's stuck. If he's supposed to be a knowledgeable person, let's say, someone who, or at least someone who should aspire for knowledge, someone who's supposed to be spending their time studying Torah, it means that they are being prevented from studying certain aspects of Torah. When I was in Kutzlaritz, that means when I was abroad outside the land of Israel, I knew that many Jews were deprived of certain aspects of the Torah.
Right.
It's true. But it wasn't, there was someone actively there. It's just, that's not part of their routine. That's not what they did. But then I came to Eretz Israel, to the land of Israel, and something even crazier happened. So that there were people who might have been aware that, yes, studying certain aspects, certain sections, you know, the Torah, you know, the five books of Moses, studying certain parts of that with the commentaries and, let's say, Maimonides, you know, what he wrote, will bring you to the obvious and necessary conclusion. So they're actively preventing people from studying these things, lest they come to realize that the status quo, especially with regards to the Temple Mount, is not what God wants. Can you believe that? Even exists here. I think there's people conspiring here to make sure that people not learn these things, lest they come to actually say, hey, maybe we should be doing things differently.
Well, because they were taught that it's not allowed. So if you believe something is forbidden, then you have a responsibility to make sure everybody knows and keeps away from. So how do we deal with this almost, I would say, new phenomenon? Because for me, it's pretty new.
Well,
I mean, I've been going up for, let's say, 7 years.
So what's new? What's new to you?
I'm saying it's new in that it's this generation versus the previous generation.
I mean, going to the Temple Mount is new.
Yeah. I know my parents, my father especially, says, we don't do that. It's not what we do.
Yeah, that's just what are you going
to
do?
It took me a long time to get over that because it's hard to go against what you were taught. And it's really,
for Jewish people, it is important that we know there. We should know what we do. We do this. This is what we do as Jews. But we are also bidden every single day to study the Torah and study it Talmudically. It means question, ask for proofs to a position, come to conclusions. Everybody has to do that, including women with regards to that which they're involved. You know, they're certainly not as obligated as men to study every aspect of the Torah.
Right.
As a matter of fact, and we might even be forbidden to teach them certain aspects, but that which is relevant to them and obligates them, that which they run, you know, kashrus in the kitchen, a woman has to know. So the problem is that this characteristic of ours is being used to our disadvantage. Yeah, this is what we don't do, but you have to ask the question, is it right that we don't do this? Imagine you keep a Jew locked up in prison for long enough. You know, if you kept them in Europe for long enough, they say this is maybe we're supposed to stay here. They'll, like I said, it will come with reasons. You have to break them out. You have to, one of the ways you can break them out is stick to the Torah study, show them the sources. If someone's objective about Torah study, then eventually you'll have to come across the clear passages, the numerous passages that demand of him, for example, to live in the land of Israel and cultivate the land of Israel. And of course, participate in temple-related matters, which are impossible without going to the Temple Mount. So we'll say, yeah, but the temple isn't there. Yes, we have an obligation to build it. These are concrete steps towards the reinstitution of the temple service and the rebuilding of the temple. That's what the goal is. We're working toward this. People say, but there's no temple. How do you expect it to show up? You know, it's not, this isn't, you know, we don't live in fairy tale land. We have to actually work toward these goals. And that's what we're trying to do. So if you pray, if you're as a Jew, you pray for the restoration of the temple. And also you say the same Shemone Esrei 3 times a day. The Shemone Esrei concludes with a number of prayers for the restoration of the temple and the temple service. Then you'll realize, oh, I have to be part of this. But people actually have to think about that. You have to show it to everybody. I think that's the challenge I think is of today for the Jewish people on the whole, to show them that these are the facts and that's what they want. It's amazing. You think it's something so simple, so obvious, would be obvious, but it's not.
Okay, so for someone listening and thinking, it's intriguing, maybe I should try it out. What do they need to know before they go up? Because it is, you know, the holiest place in the world.
Okay.
And there are certain rituals that you have to perform.
So we certainly don't have time to say, what do you need to know? You have to ritually purify yourself before you go.
Okay.
So there are things to know. The most basic form of ritual purification is immersion in the ritual bath. Okay. Tefillah and a mikvah, as they say in Yeshivish. So if you want, we have other resources that tell you how to prepare for doing so.
Right.
But by the way, immersion in the ritual bath, ritual purification, used to be a part of daily life for Jewish people. So these laws weren't kept for a while, but you know they do exist, and they are legislated, and there are those who study them in depth. There are basic Talmudic and Halachic texts that describe this. And fortunately, many women, especially the married ones, are familiar with preparing themselves for ritual immersion in the ritual bath. It's the same mikveh they go to for their own personal reasons is the one they should go to prepare for ascending the Temple Mount. And men also have ritual baths that they could go to. It's certainly easier for a man to get ready for mikveh.
Right.
So that's what they're supposed to do. So learn how to do it and go do it. And like I said, there's much more details. But remember, you're going to God's house. So there's specific rules. You can't even wear your shoes. You're not supposed to carry your walking stick. I saw a guy go to the Temple Mount wearing his shoes and carrying his walking stick. I went to one of the regulars, said, maybe you should tell him. It's like specifically he's not supposed to. Oh, yeah, but he's got a boo-boo. He's got an ouchie of some sort. He hurt his foot. So he needs to wear these special shoes and he has to, you know, have a cane. Like, so he's exempt. The Torah didn't say like, oh, yeah, but if you, you know, you're uncomfortable, so you can break the rules. There's rules you should know. It's the most governed place on earth where the rules certainly apply. That's what makes it holy. The definition of the holiness of the Temple Mount is that more rules apply to it than other places. So
but here's the point, though. A lot of people say, so because we don't know the rules or we haven't been taught the rules or you're bound to get people going up there that aren't keeping the rules, then we should just make it forbidden for everyone so that nobody has break the rules.
That's silly.
Yeah.
Do we do that with any other aspect of life?
I don't know.
We're telling people, no, of course not. We have kashrus. Kashrus is complicated. You know, if you slaughter the cow the wrong way, or even after you slaughter it properly, you don't properly remove the blood and the forbidden fat. So you have extreme Torah prohibitions on the same level, by the way, as those entering areas of the Temple Mount that you're not supposed to. By the way, Temple Mount is huge. There are areas you're not supposed to go to. Those usually involve going up steps and going through barriers, things that they won't let you go to anyway, so you're probably not going to do it. To say that, oh, this could involve severe Torah prohibitions, doesn't mean you should just say, okay, don't do it. Otherwise, by the way, we would not allow marriage, by the way.
Right.
If you were involved in any sort of physical relationship with a member of the opposite sex, or, you know, you're intending to do so, just to know, you're flirting with severe Torah prohibitions. But if you do it right, so you're fulfilling a commandment. And by the way, also consumption of food. Consumption of food involves, you know, trying to avoid the severe prohibitions. We don't tell people, you know what, just eat broccoli every single day. Even broccoli is a problem. Okay. I don't know. Eat cucumbers. The ones that cucumbers and tomatoes and is that it? The only things that don't have bugs?
I don't know.
You know, we don't do that. We don't tell people they have to be vegetarians. We don't tell people they have to be celibate. Okay. We say there's a challenge and we will learn to do the challenge. You know, we learn to beat this challenge. And we are like it says in Pirkei Avos, lo alecham l'chaligmor. You know, it's not upon you to finish the job. You can't learn everything. But you're also not free to just say, you know what, I can't do it. Got to keep trying. And these rules are quite simple. They're made available for, you know, laymen. Okay?
Right.
Okay? God wanted every single layman to make the pilgrimage to his temple at least 3 times a year. So this is something that's doable. This isn't impossible. Saying, so you're not used to it, trust me. As you should expect of your husband, if he's the type of man who is yeshiva trained, or even he's just less, okay? But he does respect Torah scholars and he's good enough to learn a little bit of Torah on a Shabbos, he should be able to learn how to attend the Temple Mount according to the halacha.
Yeah. And some of my clients have gone up with me and we've made it into a fun outing. So if you're interested, just get in touch and we can get it going. It's really a very special experience. I think, you know, from all the different things that we learn as part of this podcast and also working with me, becoming intentional, becoming grounded, connecting, strengthening your relationship with God and the people around you, this is probably the best way to do it, is really just physically being in that location is really special.
Yeah, you just got to get there, you know?
Yeah, come get it. Okay, cool. I invite you guys to get in touch with me. Also, if you are interested in working together, I do have a 3-month private coaching package. It's called Balance for God's Sake. And it's really awesome. Tell them to work with me.
Okay, I don't know what that particular package is about because you have a few things that you say, a fly and a this and a few acronyms. But I do know, this is what I can attest to. You've helped a lot of people.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, and you're very good at it. That's why people are seeking you out. It's just like, yeah, we'll hire you to be like the graphic designer so that we can really just keep you as our actual PR and HR, more importantly. You know, human resources, but also human relationships. That's what it should be.
Yeah.
Advisor. Yeah, you helped a lot of people. You know, you found what you're good at.
Thank you. The
trick is to find what you're good at and stick to it. So if you... Yeah, I would say if you have problems, but whatever. Even if you don't have a particular issue, this is the address.
Right. And
it's where I go to too. You could need good advice. Need someone to, you know, walk you through the right thing. Right. Whatever all those other women are getting out of it also.
Yeah. It's really great. They're getting a lot of balance out of it.
I know people are jealous. You know, they said people come by, you know, for excuses that I want to like do something with you so that I could get free advice. You know? You know that. That's how it goes. You know, like, I want to just talk. Oh, good. Come for a barbecue. That way you get to talk to you for 2 hours.
Yeah.
You know, look, there's a reason people do that.
Yeah.
They don't do it to me.
You know? Yeah, they do. You have guys not coming.
Yeah, but not the same thing. You know, if you're a 19-year-old yeshiva guy and you're trying to understand why the Rambam wrote this and wrote that, and you know, what's the relationship between the Bava and Rishami? So they come to me hoping that maybe I'll have an answer, but they don't come with like these, you know, the type of stuff that you help people with.
Yeah. You know,
yeah, it's very important.
So what do I help people with?
I know it's like women's things. Women have their issues and you talk it out with them. But even some men have girly issues, right?
Girly issues.
I think it's, you know, like
I
I
don't
say
work
that.
with men.
I know. I'm just saying, even men have those types of things. I wish I could understand it,
They're
but
called emotions.
oh, so those that's that feeling. Okay, now begin to say, okay, so happiness. Okay, now I've understood that.
Yeah.
As far as I could see, for many men, it's usually a technical problem. They want to say, how do I go about doing this in my job? But for women, it's an emotional issue. They have to talk out what they're doing. And you're very good for doing that. I'll tell you something I discovered about my wife. You know how they say true beauty lies within? So most men are blind to that. Men look at outward beauty. They see, like, you know, they especially when they look at women, it's like, that's why men shouldn't be looking at women so much. They think it's attractive or not. That's what a man thinks. But a woman that doesn't look at men necessarily that way, and a woman still doesn't look at women necessarily that way. You don't see the physical beauty. You're entirely already beyond that. You actually know how to see people's inner beauty. And that's all you see. You actually see people's personality. Like, you can understand people's emotions and personalities as though you're actually seeing it in front of your face. You know, you're almost blind to people's physical imperfections because that doesn't even exist. You're already x-raying them. You're seeing their mind, which is something I can't do. It's something I don't know anybody else can do, but you can do it. So, you know, that's the more power. So that's why you're so good at what you're doing. You know?
Thank you. Yeah,
Yeah. So,
that's pretty accurate. I never thought about it that way.
It's just that I heard there was one guy who's a well-known professional psychiatrist. He told me that certain musicians, like the most gifted musicians, like to take a Mozart, for example, was just gifted in music. He was a real pervert and really not the type of role model. But people like him could see music as colors, you know?
Yeah.
So you see emotions and, you know, personality traits and the way people are behaving. You actually, like, see it in a way that most of us can't even perceive it. Okay. And let's say a guy like me who can barely perceive other people's emotions, you know, like that for me, that to me, that's a superpower. You know, as you say, that's it must be a superpower.
It is a
Yeah.
superpower. I'm very grateful.
Yeah.
Okay, here's the fun last question.
Wait,
What is,
that's what you're paying me for, right?
yeah,
Okay.
exactly. What does the calm method stand for?
I knew this once upon a time. Calm. I don't know. Give me the first thing. Maybe I could start with. So give me the
Okay,
C.
connect.
No, I still don't know. Connect.
Connect to yourself.
I don't know. Connect to yourself. What else? I don't know. You
What's
tell me.
the A?
I don't know. Always laugh more.
No.
Connect. Always laugh more. It spells it. I don't know.
Connect yourself. Ask for abundance.
Avi loves meatballs. I don't know.
Avi loves meatballs. That's true
I
too.
don't know. Connect yourself. Abundance. Okay. Love.
Ask, okay, connect to yourself is step
Okay. Oh, it's
one.
a verb. So you see, ask.
Ask for abundance is step two.
Okay.
Listen for the answer.
Okay. Listen to the. Okay. Fine.
And step three.
And move on with your life. What?
It's the exact opposite of move on with your life. It's master a higher level of consciousness, which is pause and celebrate what just happened before you move on with your life.
Okay, fine. What does Yal Kagam stand for?
I have no idea. That's not a method I
Okay, that's in
created.
the Talmud. Fine. Lo Adu Rosh. You know what that stands for? Adu.
Yes, I do know.
Really? Oh, I told you that?
I grew up on that before I
Okay,
knew you,
fine.
before you were born.
Okay,
It's
fine. So I don't know what calm stands for. I'm sorry.
okay. I think everybody will find that very comical.
Really?
Yeah.
Wait, comical or comical?
I don't know. I don't speak English.
This is how we actually behave at home.
Yeah.
Except I'm a lot more impatient when the camera's off. Oh, boy.
Oh, thank you so
Right?
much for being here on our podcast.
Thanking me for being in my own house.
Yeah,
Okay. Well,
for being on our
thank
podcast.
you so much for putting on a tie for the camera. Okay.
If you guys have any questions, let us know, and maybe one day we'll do this again.
Wait, we have to do it again?
No, I don't
Oh.
know. Maybe next year.
Okay, fine.
We'll give him some time to cool off. Okay, well, thank you so much for being with us for this episode of the Connected for Real podcast. Make sure that you go and subscribe, tell all your friends. This is an awesome podcast. Usually I have a guest every single week, and sometimes I sprinkle in some solo episodes. So look out for those. They're really great too. I look forward to seeing you next week. And don't forget to be connected for real.
I won't be here next week.
No, you won't be here next week. Thanks so much for being here this week.
And that's it. Thank you for listening to the very end. I would love if you can leave a review and subscribe to the podcast. Those are things that tell the algorithm this is a good podcast, and make sure to suggest it to others. Wouldn't it be amazing if more people became more connected for real? And now take a moment and think of someone who might benefit from this episode. Can you share it with them? I am Revitzen Batren Grossman from connectedforreal.com. Thank you so much for listening, and don't forget, you can be connected for real.